Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. The Proslogion, a short work by Anselm of Canterbury, is largely known by most people within the world of ideas, if they indeed know of it at all, because of something that's often called the ontological argument, which occurs in chapters 2 through 4 of the work, and which you can actually cull out of chapter 2 itself. And Anselm didn't intend the work to center solely on that. In fact, he talks of a single argument running through the entirety of the work, and the ontological, really so-called ontological, because it's not Anselm's terminology for that, but rather that of much later authors like Immanuel Kant, the argument there is only a piece of a much larger and much more complex single argument that runs through almost all of the work. So what is that argument? If we want to understand that, the first place to go to is not the argument itself. It's actually the introduction or proemium to the work itself, where he tells us why he has written this. And he tells us about his motivation. Anselm had previously written another, much longer work called the Monologium. And this one was, as he calls it here, a whole set of connected arguments. It was a multorum concatenatione contextum argumentorum. So there were multiple arguments, argumentorum is the plural of that, and they were woven together and in some respect kind of heaped up upon each other. And they were dealing with different aspects of the divine substance and its relations with the human knower and lover and being and with the rest of creation. And Anselm, he wasn't quite happy with the Monologion. He said, I wanted to see if I could find a single argument, unum argumentum, right? A single, you could say, demonstration or explanation, some sort of logical, some sort of rational account. And this one would require no other. So it would be, you could say, self-grounding. It wouldn't require some other arguments to provide the original premises for it. It would work on its own. So that's one key aspect of this unum argumentum. Then he said that he thought about it a lot and he struggled with the idea. And at first he didn't really make any progress. As a matter of fact, it's really great to hear it in his own words. He says that, I turned my thoughts to this with great diligence. Sometimes I thought I could already grasp what I was looking for, and sometimes it escaped my mind completely. Finally, I gave up hope. I decided to stop looking for something that was impossible to find. So it's difficult to find something that doesn't require any other grounding or argument. And it's also difficult to make one wrap one's head around these sort of complex matters to begin with. So he struggled with the argument and then he rejected it. And then after he rejected it, like any sort of thought that you say, I'm never going to think about this, what happens to you? He says, I tried to stifle it or repress it altogether, lest by occupying my mind with useless speculation, it would keep me from things I could actually accomplish. Then it began to hound me, to pursue me more and more, to impose itself upon me. That's an interesting way to talk about a line of thinking, isn't it? It's not just an argument in the sense of some things set down on paper. Anselm is thought, he has in mind here living thought. And he tells us that he has this struggle and he rejects it. And then he has sort of a breakthrough. He says, I resisted it and fought against it. Then one day when my violent struggle against its hounding had worn me down, the thing I despaired of finding presented itself in the very clash of my thoughts. And then he says, I eagerly embraced that thought. The Latin comes from the word to sort of go around. He actually says, here we go. When I was worn out with resisting its importunacy, I eagerly grasped the notion, studioso cogitationem amplectoretur, quam solicitus repellebam. I grabbed it. I wrapped myself around it. So he embraced it. Now, what was this argument supposed to do? We're going to get to that in a moment. Usually, we think of arguments as a matter of convincing other people. We provide arguments so that we can get other people to agree with us, to see things our way. And when it comes to arguments about God, we often call this apologetics. And the idea is, well, we can take an unbeliever and provide them with an argument, and they will become a believer thereby and acknowledge that there must be a God. That is not what Anselm was trying to do in writing this down. He tells us that he actually had a primarily aesthetic motive. What do we mean by an aesthetic motive? Well, he says that he was so filled with joy at finding this argument that he thought that he would share it with others and thereby give them enjoyment or pleasure. And so by setting it down, he's not simply trying to convince people that God exists. He's trying to give them a line of thought that will be, in fact, enjoyable for them to dig into. So what is this argument supposed to do? He actually tells us, and this is a very important point, that it's going to do three related kinds of things. So the first thing is to demonstrate or to prove or to, how else should we put it, to lead a person through understanding progressively more and more, ad struendum in Latin, which is not to simply prove, but to demonstrate. So the argument is supposed to demonstrate that God exists, but he doesn't just say God exists, Deus esse, he says God truly or really exists, Deus vera est, right? So there's already an interesting emphasis there. As a matter of fact, in the so-called ontological argument, he's going to use, besides the term esse, being, or est is in Latin, he's going to use the term existit, to exist in such a way that it sort of puts itself out there in the original sense of the term. So that's one thing. But then there's another motive that's equally important for this single argument running throughout the proslogion, that God is the supreme good. Demonstrating that, needing no other, requiring no other, and going further, that all other things have need of, in order for them to have being, that is esse, and in order for them to be well, bene esse. So you could say, well, first you have to prove that God exists, and then you can prove this other stuff, and existence is more important. For Anselm, existence does come first in the order, but the being of God is goodness. The being of God is to be this supreme good that all other goods require and that gives all other things their being and their being well. These are not separate moves within the movement of thought, right? They're all part of the same thing. Then the other thing that he says that this argument is supposed to prove is really a set of other things. As we see, whatever we believe about the divine substance. So here he's talking about the things that religious believers, and here, he has in mind Western Catholic Christians, whatever it is that they believe about the divine being or divine substance, quae cumque de divina credimus substantia. And he says that we want this argument to suffice to do all of these things. Now, if you examine the work itself, the proslogion in its structure, what do you find? And here I've got sort of a summary of the different chapters. And this is very important. The very first chapter, you might not consider that to be part of the argument. He calls that an excitatio mentis, an arousing of the mind. And what is the point of that? To the contemplation ad contemplandum Deum. And you notice that in that, he is trying to, you know, he's talking to his own mind, his own soul, saying, stir yourself up, little man, try to raise your thoughts. But he's also lamenting his damaged condition, something that will become a theme later on when he talks about how he kind of understands God, but also doesn't understand him. He doesn't see God, even though he's seeking him. And why is that? It's not because there's something wrong with God, but because there's something wrong with him. And he prays in this. He asks God to form and reform him. Now, that's a weird way to start a treatise on the nature of God or the existence of God, is it not? To be talking to the very being whose existence you're demonstrating. 2 through 4 are the what so-called ontological argument. In chapter 2, he gives you the famous argument that begins from the idea of God, or not a definition, but a characterization of God as quo maius cogitari non posit, that is, that than which greater cannot be thought, or a greater cannot be thought. He changes the terminology a little bit. Every once in a while, he changes posit into valeat, or he changes the wording around from time to time. But that it holds fairly constant. What's most interesting about this is he doesn't just use that for chapters 2 through 4, where he's talking about the existence or being of God. He is actually using that throughout the rest, chapters 5 through 23, where he is also talking about the goodness of God and exploring that topic at considerable length. Goodness in terms of power, goodness in terms of justice and mercy, goodness in terms of whatever else God gives, you know, life, reason, and he actually gets us to the point within the middle of these chapters where God is not just that than which a greater cannot be thought, but God is greater than what can be thought, that is, by human beings. So all these other matters are being considered there, even matters of eternity or whether God is a Trinity. There's a lot packed into that set of chapters. And that is all part of this single argument. It's all beginning from the same basic starting point, characterizing, not defining, by the way. Anselm is very careful to say when he's being criticized that he is not providing a definition of God. He is simply saying God is that than which nothing greater can be thought, and showing what some of the consequences of that would be for the attentive human mind who wants to follow it out. The last 3 chapters are not part of the unum argumentum, the single argument. They are, you could say, added on. They are, to use the title of the very first one of them, conjectures or speculations. Conjectatio, and we could say conjectationes in the plural, right? And so they go beyond the scope of the argument itself, and they're primarily about what it's going to be like to enjoy that good in heaven. So they're quite interesting. You might also say that in a certain sense, it's not part of the unum argumentum, but it's a rather commentary on it. The monk, Gonillo, the critic of Anselm, who primarily targets chapters 2 through 4 and says everything else, I'm good with that, and Anselm's response to Gonillo, those Anselm ordered to be copied along with the proslogion So they really are part of the work, but they are not part of the unum argumentum. The unum argumentum really runs from chapter 2 to chapter 23, and it encompasses all of these different things understood as being interrelated. So the unum argumentum is not the ontological argument. The ontological argument, in fact, is not an argument in the sense that Anselm is using it here, because he's claiming he has a single argument, that what we call the ontological argument is just a portion of. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.